I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and is heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces radio network. Sports Byline has been called the Nightline of Sports for its insightful, human, sometimes humorous, and certainly always interesting interviews with the biggest names in sports. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk with linebacker Daryl Talley about his 14-year NFL career and his four trips to the Super Bowl. Also, we'll remember John Wooden, a man who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame not once, but twice, and who many call the greatest coach ever. And Adonal Foyle will join us. Foyle's life is a story of determination as he grew up on a small Caribbean island and became an NBA first-round pick who had a 13-year career. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Daryl Talley. Talley is the epitome of an NFL linebacker, a chiseled body, determination, and a drive to be the best. A product of West Virginia University, Talley was drafted in the second round by the Buffalo Bills. He spent 12 seasons with the Bills during their glory years. Under Marv Levy, Talley and the Bills went to four consecutive Super Bowls, but each time came up short. Talley is philosophical about the experience, saying, "I was fortunate to have four bites of the apple, even though I didn't eat the whole thing." Talley is a true Midwesterner, having grown up in Cleveland. I asked him how much of Cleveland rubbed off on him in the way he played football and as a person.
It's all of it. That's me. That's the way it is. That's the way the majority of the people are in my area. I mean, everybody believes in going to work, doing their job for a fair day's pay. And if you don't do that, then everybody frowns on you going, "Wait a minute, what do you think you are? You think you're something special? You don't have to work?" Everybody's got to work. Everybody's got to put their nose to the grindstone and keep it there if you want to be successful in this world.
You also grew up in a family in which you had a mother and a father that gave input to you. You have a brother, right?
Oh, yes. Brother? Yes, yeah. I did. Believe me, my parents stayed on the two of us because I think if they hadn't stayed on us, we wouldn't know where we would be at right now. But we were kind of mischievous as kids, me and my brother.
What was the neighborhood like?
Neighborhood was it's like you would see one of those old-fashioned neighborhoods where if you messed up in a neighborhood, if you messed up down the street, you got your butt beat down the street, then when you were on your way home crying from getting your butt beat by one of the neighbors, then you got home, the neighbor then called your mom got you when you got in the door, and you got another whooping. So I'm like, you know what? It didn't do you any good to do anything wrong around here. You're going to get trouble anyway you go.
I remember Jackie Joyner Kersey telling me she grew up over in East St. Louis, across the river from St. Louis, and she said, "We never stood a chance of going wrong because we weren't afraid of the police. We were more afraid of mom and dad."
You're afraid of getting your butt beat when you got home. Trust me, fear is something. Fear, it'll drive you nuts. I mean, you're actually sitting there going, "Oh, my God, I can't wait. I hope he comes in and is in a nice mood. Hope my dad's not mad today."
Mm-hmm. What'd your dad do?
My dad was a sawmaster in the foundry in Cleveland.
And your mom?
Mom worked in a Colonial woolen mill. She worked in a woolen mill, putting yarn on bobbins and stuff like that.
What were the pressures that you faced as a kid? Because we hear about what kids have to deal with today.
The pressures I faced as a kid, I really didn't have too many pressures because it's like they say, didn't have a whole lot of things when I was young, but what we did had, my parents made sure you knew how to take care of what you had. It had to be washed, cleaned, and pressed. You just took care of your stuff. You didn't just throw it on the ground like you see kids today. They would just throw stuff on the ground. My kids now, I yell at them every day for it. They just throw stuff on the ground and think, "Oh, well, Dad will come by and pick it up."
Was it a mixed neighborhood that you lived in?
For the most part, no. We were the second black family to move into my neighborhood. And the funny part about it is we were the second black family to move into my neighborhood. And 5 years down the road, maybe seven, when I got to high school, I went to a 98.8% all black high school. And when I moved in the neighborhood, we were the second black family in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Where did sports come into your life? What time?
Sports came into my life really actually kind of funny because my old man looked at me and he says, "You want to play football, son? Want to play baseball?" I played baseball, and he said, "You want to play football?" I said, looked at him, I thought about it. I said, "Pop, I'll play football if you play football." My dad said, "Okay." My dad went out and played on a semi-pro football team. He was a kicker. He kicked in high school. So he kicked, and he was a middle linebacker. But on the semi-pro team, all he did was kick. And he said he was going to go kick. I said, "If he can kick, I can play." And my first time playing on the field was really, really funny. Short story, I'm out there playing the game. My dad, everybody else has got a uniform on. The guy tells my dad what color the jerseys are and everything, what color the pants are. Well, you seen the way the Buffalo Bills jerseys look right now?
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of jersey my dad bought me. He took and bought those iron-on letters, numbers, and put them on, put my name on the back of the shirt for me. But everybody else's shirt was blue. My shirt was gold with blue balls on the top of the shoulders. And everybody said, well, Daryl, didn't you feel out of place with your shirt on like that? And everybody else had a different color shirt? I said, no. Because my shirt was clean and my shirt was new. I didn't care what they had on. Guy put me in the game. First play I go in the game, I'm standing there, it's a muddy field. I put my hand on the ground, play a snap, guy goes by me, I look. I'm not getting dirty. My mom and they're yelling at me. I'm not getting my clothes dirty. Came in halftime. Coach looked at me, he says, son, I was playing defensive tackle, and I'm the cleanest person on the field. He says, son, this game's not for prima donnas. If you're going to play football, you got to get down in the dirt and get dirt on your knees and your hands and everywhere. So I looked at him. I looked at my old man. My old man stood there, shook his head. So I went back out the second half. I came off the field. My mother told me I couldn't get in the car. I was covered in mud from the top of my helmet to my toes, covered. There was nothing you could see. And the uniforms were gold pants, blue shirts, which mine was yellow, and everything was just mud. And my mother just said, look, just take off everything you got on right now. We'll put it in the trunk of the car, and you'll go home. I went home in my underwear and T-shirt because my mother refused to let me get in the back seat of the car.
Were you a Cleveland Browns fan growing up then?
No, I actually wasn't. I actually wasn't a Cleveland Browns fan. I wasn't a real big fan of football. I mean, I watched it. I got to go to a game every now and then. Didn't really have a favorite team. I like certain players. And then everybody knows me that DeStork was one of my idols and Ted Hendricks and Jack Tatum were two of my idols because I loved the way Tatum hit people. And plus he went to Ohio State and I loved Ted Hendricks for the things that he did on the field. I mean, here's a guy that's 6'7" that can block passes, cover running backs, rush the quarterback, block punts, field goals. He could do just about anything he wanted to on the field. And, you know, I said, that's the kind of player I want to be. I want to be able to do everything that I can do on the field. Well, I got to the point to where I could block punts, block passes, cover running backs coming out of the backfield, and tackle people and have a lot of fun at it. So, you know, I looked at it and said, it's a good idea. But the thing that I really loved was watching Tatum run through people. I used to watch him and George Atkinson hit people, and I used to sit there and go, yep, I need me some skull and crossbones just so I can hit somebody like that.
I had Tatum and Atkinson in the studio here one night, just where you were sitting. And Fox called, the former player for the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
And he called, and we were laughing and talking. And I said, wait a minute, what did you learn most from these two guys? He said,
how to duck.
Not how to duck, and also how to grab somebody from behind, pull them down, and not get a penalty.
You would have to duck real quick with the two of them.
It really was. When did football get serious to you? And what I mean serious is when did you think, hey, wait a minute, maybe I can do something with this, get an education, and maybe even have a pro career?
Now, this is going to be really funny. I only played 10 games in high school, 10 varsity games. I played 7 my junior year because I broke my hand fighting. I played 3 my senior year because I broke my ankle. And we played against the number 2, 3, and 5 team in the state. And I made just about every tackle on the field, but 2 and 2 of the games. And the other one, I made 18 tackles in it. And the coach came up to me and he says, son, where have you been? I said, I've been sitting on the sideline. I had a broke ankle. You just got off a broke ankle and you run like that? I said, yeah. And that led me to get a scholarship to school because I had written everybody. I wrote Ohio State, Michigan State. Michigan, everybody trying to get myself a scholarship to school or get somebody to take a look at me because I didn't think anybody would. And long story short, none of those guys came calling. Only people called me was Syracuse, West Virginia, Iowa and Iowa State. And I said, Iowa and Iowa State is just too far away from home for me to go. I like to stay close to my mom and dad so I can see them and talk to them. Well, I could have done that on the phone, but they couldn't come see me play. Really never thought about playing professional football. Never. Not one time.
Did you see going to college as an opportunity merely to get an education then?
Just to get an education to do something I enjoyed doing. I looked at it, I could get an education and do something I enjoyed doing. And going into my senior year in high school, in college, you know, I'd made all East and everything else, but I never really gave two shakes up about it. You know, everybody's like, he doesn't even get it. And it came down to a game I played in Pittsburgh where I was the Sports Illustrated Player of the Week, and I had a pretty good game. I blocked the punt, scored, picked the ball up, scored, made had 15 tackles. Guy looked at me. He says, you know you're going to get drafted, right? I looked at him. I said, I thought they ended the draft. I'm not going to the Army. He said, no, dummy, in the NFL. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not worried about it. Well, if I get drafted, I get drafted. But I didn't think I was getting drafted. And he looked at me. He says, are you kidding me? You really don't think so? I said, no. Had no idea. Didn't even think about it.
Darrell Talley has joined us here on Sports Byline, the former linebacker in the NFL, most of those years in a Buffalo Bills uniform. We were talking about West Virginia. You were a kid that came out of the city in Cleveland, but you end up on a mountaintop. You know where I'm going with
this. I know.
What was that like for you? Was that a culture shock?
It is a real big culture shock. I mean, you go from being in the city to being in the mountains, or what I called it was Morgan Hole, because Morgantown's actually sitting down in a hole between mountains. And when I got there, the people were friendly and everything, and I had a great visit. I enjoyed my host, and I enjoyed the place there. I thought I would have fun at school there. But boy, was I in for a rude awakening. There was no radio stations. There was only a McDonald's there. There wasn't anything else. Then they brought in a Hardee's. I mean, I went back after I got elected into their Football Hall of Fame, or into the school's Hall of Fame there, and to see the things and the way that town's grown, they got martini bars in college. I didn't know they existed. We had quarter beer night, nickel beer night. That was big for us. And, I mean, just looking at some of the things that have gone on in that town is unbelievable.
I had the same experience because my grandparents lived in Parkersburg, West Virginia. Now picture this for a second. My dad was in the military, and so we lived in places like Germany, Paris, London.
Might be nice.
And for 9 months of the year, that's where I lived. For the 3 months in the summer, I went to Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Ooh.
You talk about culture.
Paris?
Stuff. Yeah.
From Paris to Parkersburg? To Parkersburg? Nah, I don't think it was a whole lot. The food had to be completely different.
Well, it was, but the people were really, really wonderful, and that's what I came away with more than anything else. But for you, a young man that comes out of a city environment, and also being an African American going there, what was that like?
It was a bit of a culture shock because the school was perhaps, I want to say, 95% all white school because it's a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there going, wow, why did I come to school here? And you look around, you have a good time, you see people there. I think it just gave me a different outlook on life as to what people in other parts of the country live like. And I think that interested me more than anything else because I got to find out what a guy from West Virginia was like. I met one of my good friends. His name's Mike Dawson. Mike Dawson had never seen a black person before. He thought black people had tails. He walked up to me, and he's looking at me, and a buddy of mine, Calvin Turner, was there at the same time. He looked at me, and he's going, I said, Calvin, what's wrong with him? What's wrong with this boy, man? I don't have to take him out. Now, mind you, Mike Dawson is a curly-haired blonde guy, blue eyes, huge guy. He's a linebacker. He's just walking around, get behind. Man, what's wrong with you? And Calvin said, man, he think we got tails. I said, no, man, I don't have a tail. See, I pulled my pants down. I said, see, I don't have a tail hanging out. It's not tucked up and rolled in my underwear or anything. And me and him became great friends. He yelled at me one year. We're playing Penn State. We had a chance to beat Penn State at West Virginia, which would have been a first because we never beat them. He blocks the punt, and in the process of blocking the punt, he falls and tears up his knee. I'm the guy that's supposed to come in and scrape up the ball if he blocked it. So I get in there. I fumbled the ball out of the end zone. He wanted to know if I got the touchdown. I told him, no, Mike, I didn't get the touchdown. I got a safety. He read me the riot act screaming. And the coach is looking at him like, why is he screaming at you about the ball not being a touchdown and you kicking it out of bounds? I said, I don't know. He just tore up his knee. I want to see how he feels. He didn't want no parts of it. He wanted the touchdown. So that right there in itself started to instill in me, no matter what happens, you play the game as hard as you can and try and score every time you can.
Let me fast forward for just a second. The class of 83 that came into the NFL, probably, and I think most people would agree, the greatest class. I mean, there was Dan Marino, there was John Elway, there was Jim Kelly, there were others like that. What was draft day like for you?
Draft day for me was torture because I graded out in the combines as the fifth best player in the draft, supposedly. And came time for draft day. Draft day came around. And because I told them I had a pinched nerve in my neck and shoulder, I'd never missed a game or anything, and the draft was so rich, I slipped from possibly the fifth pick, which San Diego took Billy Ray Smith in that spot. There was no other linebacker taken in the first round that year except for him, and went to the second round. And I just looked at it, and I said, okay, fine. This is the way it's going to be. Then it's going to be a fight. We're going to fight every day I'm there. So they're going to know I'm there the whole time I'm in the league, because I'm going to make sure that they know I'm there and they're not going to skip over me again. Well, they did it again when it came around time to vote for the Pro Bowl. They skipped right over me. For years they did that to me. So, you know, it's always been an uphill fight for me.
How did you feel about being drafted by Buffalo?
I didn't mind it. You know, I thought Buffalo was here's how bad my geography was when it came to figuring out where Buffalo was. I thought Buffalo was right outside of Manhattan. And I'm growing up in Cleveland, and it's only 2.5 hours away from me. So I'm going, oh, I can go to the city every week. I'm going to like this. I get to Buffalo. New York City is 6 hours away. I'm going, 6 hours? That's a long drive. But the good thing about that, they had People's Express, which used to fly us from Buffalo to New York for $49.
Right.
So that was the only thing. Going there didn't bother me about the weather because – the weather's just like it is in Cleveland. It may be 10 degrees colder, but it's 10 degrees warmer in Cleveland in the summer. That's it.
When you take a look back on it, Darryl, was the Buffalo franchise and Darryl Talley a marriage made in heaven? Because I always sensed there was such a comfort factor for you, just the environment, the coaches you had, the players you had around you.
Well, that became that way, but at the beginning
not
it wasn't.
Not at the beginning.
At the beginning, yeah. I was a 2-14, 4-12, and 4-12. So I heard all of the knock-knock jokes there were, and it just became the idea that, you know what, there were a nucleus of us that were there that were really young and said, forget it. We're not going to take it anymore. The comment that comes to mind the most was Jim Kelly came to me, and he said, okay, hey, DT, it's our team now. We're the guys that's got to run this. It's our squad. Let's us do it as a team. And that right there said, okay. We're going to do everything as one. So if one of us went out, all of us went out. It didn't matter whether it was Jim versus the 13 snapper. If you were going to go out, hey, what are you doing tonight? Well, come on, go with me. Just grab a – it didn't matter who it was. You just never went out by yourself. So everybody sort of bonded together and stayed there, stayed together with each other and sort of took care of each other. And the people at Buffalo are really great, generous people. I mean, they're opening their hearts up to you as long as you're willing to go out there and work. If you're going to work for them, they'll appreciate you, and they'll show you they appreciate you.
Yeah, I saw a lot of similarities between Buffalo and Cleveland in the blue-collar kind of atmosphere. Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, that kind of triangle right there.
That's what I used to tell them. I said, look, I'm going to bring my lunch bucket, and I'm going to work. Because that's the only way you could do it, because if you did it any other way, you're going to feel like you're slighting somebody or you're cheating somebody, and that's one thing that my old man wouldn't go for. You ain't going to cheat anybody at anything. You're going to do it upright.
Where did the turning point come? What was the game? What was the moment where that 2-14, 4-12, where did it turn for the Buffalo Bills and that team?
For me, when I realized it was 1987. Was it 87? 87, we were playing Philadelphia. We were playing the Eagles. It was the last game of the year, and I just so happened to look around the locker room, and I was sitting there, and I was talking to Cornelius. We were out there playing and playing exceptionally well, just beating the Eagles up. And I looked at him. I said, man, you know what? This is after the game. I said, we got a chance. We got a chance to be really, really good, man. I think we're going to blow some people away. And I said, all we got to do is stick together. We can do it. Because goes back to the same thing one of my Pee Wee coaches told me. He said, a chain's only as strong as his weakest link. And I said, I want me to be the weakest link because I know I'm not going to break.
On and off the field, Daryl Talley stayed true to his Midwest roots. Now on to basketball. This year, we lost a giant of the game. At 99, Coach John Wooden passed away. He accomplished unparalleled success as not only a coach, but as a player as well. He's one of only three people to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame twice as a player and a coach. He was an All-American player at Purdue, where he was college basketball's Player of the Year. And at UCLA, he coached the Bruins to 10 NCAA championships, including 7 in a row. Beloved by his players and respected by all, he touched many people's lives on and off the court. I talked with Coach Wooden many times on Sports Byline, and in our last conversation, I asked him, is the way the game is played today compatible with John Wooden?
Well, my philosophy wouldn't change if I were coaching today any more than making the normal changes according to the rules. With the advent of the clock and the three-point rule, you do things, of course, to take advantage of those particular situations, but otherwise my philosophy would not change.
What about all the things around college basketball, the pressures? Have they changed a great deal, and would that be something you'd be comfortable with, Coach?
Problems are problems. They change, but you always have them. And if you can't cope with the problems that exist, then you should be in something else. But if you're in something else, you'd find that there were problems there, too. I think pressure is what you put on yourself, and if you don't put pressure on yourself, you're going to lose your job.
Recruiting has always been a key part to the success of almost any college sport. How did you approach it when you were coaching at UCLA?
I wanted youngsters to want to come. I refused to initiate contact with any out-of-state students, and I seldom visited the homes. I didn't believe in that. I didn't want to talk youngsters into coming. I wanted them to know what we had to offer and for them to want to come. I liked to have them come and visit our campus and see what we had and talk with them and talk with the players that you had so they could get an evaluation from them. But I didn't want to talk them into coming, and I think any player who played for me would tell you that I didn't talk him into coming. I would tell him that if he did come, we wanted him or I wouldn't be recruiting him, but if he did come, there'd probably be times in the first year or so that he probably would think he should have gone someplace else. But in all probability, had he gone someplace else, he'd be thinking the same thing. But after a while, that would all straighten out. That was my philosophy, and I tried to stick to it.
One of your former coaching pupils, Denny Crum, was with us, John, and he was lamenting all the things that you have to do now when you walk into a home of an 18-year-old. You almost have to tell him first thing how many times you're on television. He kind of shook his head, and as we talked about it, he says, you know, it just was not that way at one time, and he said, I think it was a better time for college sports.
Well, you've got to recognize that times change, and you have to go along with them and make certain changes along with them, but essentially it remains the same. You have to get them to believe in you, trust you, and if you're honest with them, that can come about. If you give them a line of goods, even though you may get one youngster, that news will get around and you'll lose the next one. So you've got to be honest about it and give them an honest picture of everything. And if you try to paint it too rosy, I think you're painting yourself in a corner.
Mm-hmm. I know that with all the success that you have, when you have a successful program, that in a sense is an endorsement for what you're doing. But now a lot of kids want to go on and make the big money that's in the NBA because they believe that everybody's going to make it to the NBA. Is that something that coaches have to deal with today and really try to get the kids to focus on maybe the broader approach, the fact that they need an education to go along with their athletic talents?
That's no different from what they should always have been doing. You always, at all times, you must make it clear to your players that they're there, first of all, to get an education. And basketball or football or the sport may be paying for it through the scholarship, but their main purpose must always be the education. No matter how good they are, a small percentage are going to make it in the pros, and a small percentage of those who make it are going to be the stars who are going to have a long career. And yet their education is a long career. That's going to last them all their life. And if they can get a foundation to establish a meaningful life in society as a whole with the education. They can't do it just with sports.
John, it was either your way or no way in a sense because you were a disciplinarian, but when you brought in certain players into your program, Did you find that there were some that really tried to buck you for a while, and how did you turn them around, or was it that it was my way or no way?
Well, a coach has the greatest ally in the world if he'll use it, but I've found that many, many coaches are afraid to use it. The bench. They all like to play, and I could name a player that's probably the best player in his position that I had that sat on the bench almost a year until he learned that it must be a team game and it's not an individual game, and I was not interested in individual statistics. I was interested in the statistics for the team as a whole. But you can't be afraid to use it. I don't think you should bind yourself with a whole lot of rules, but when you do have a rule, you have to stick to it, no matter what individual might be involved or what his importance on the team seems to be. Every player on the team must be given the feeling that there is a place for him, there's a role for him to play. Some might be the engine in a car, and some might be just a nut holding a wheel in place. But each part is essential, and that's something that I always tried to get across to the youngsters, that many of their parts would not be in the public eye, but I would know about them, and they'd be very, very, very valuable.
Did you also find that by having that type of approach and philosophy, John, that it also helped in endorsing the team concept, where you did not have anybody who felt they were more important than any other element of the quintet on the floor?
Very definitely, and I was concerned about that from the very beginning with all the players, and stressed the fact that it was a team game, and then no player is any bigger than the team, and it's, I'm interested in their individual abilities, but how that can contribute to the team as a whole. And I tried to make that clear, and with some it was no problem, and with others it was more of a problem. I was fortunate in some of the superstars that I had, they had that concept immediately. There was no problem at all. And if a star or a superstar has that type of attitude, it makes it rather imperative that the others have it too.
I find it rather interesting to hear coaches kind of talk about the fact that they have to deal with a lot of elements that they didn't have to deal with before. Most are namely something that maybe an athlete comes from a deprived socioeconomic situation, or they come from the inner city and what have you. But yet you had athletes from every background, and yet that was never a problem. Was that because you didn't look upon it as a problem, that that was something you had to solve and you just approached it head on?
Oh, I think very definitely so. You have to... they're just basketball players out there in relation with each other and trying to establish themselves. Your job is to try to make the best team out of them. There will be different races, different religions, and I don't think it's any different today than it was when I coached or before I coached.
When you were coaching, you had those superstars, and there were some who said that you protected them from the media. You didn't really give them full exposure to the media, that you kind of fed them along the way so that they could get used to it. Was there anything to that, John?
Only in their freshman year. Their freshman year, they were very, very closely watched, and we didn't like for them to have many interviews, and that was definitely set up through our sports athletic news bureau. After that, they were on their own as far as interviews and what it was going to, as long as it didn't interfere with practices or wasn't at a time on the game day when it would be interfere with their concentration on the game particular day. But otherwise, no, I had no restrictions on them at all.
Did it bother you to hear those type of criticisms of your style?
When you're in the public eye and you can't accept the criticisms, you better get out. It's the same thing as I tried to tell my players, that there'll be times that they're going to get criticism that's unjust, and they won't like it. And sometimes it'll be just. But also, I want them to always keep in mind that at times they're going to get praise that they really don't deserve, and other times they'll get praise they deserve. They'll like it either way. But you've got to take those in stride, and your ability to accept both criticism and praise, in my opinion, will determine what kind of a person you are. You let either one of them lose your perspective about either one, whether it's praise or criticism, it's going to hurt you from being able to function according to your particular level of competency.
One of the things that I've found in talking to your former players and is that a lot of the things that they picked up, they always talk about what they learned while they were under you at UCLA and how it's carried over into other things in their life beyond their playing days.
Well, it should. Now, I've been asked many, many times, can athletics build character? And my answer has always been the same as long as I can remember. I say it can build character, but it can also tear down character.
Mm-hmm.
It depends upon the leadership, and it's up to coaches to provide leadership. I've always taken great stock in something that I read in the NEA Journal back shortly after I entered the teaching profession in the middle 30s. I read something that said, no written word, no spoken plea can teach our youth what they should be, nor all the books on all the shelves. It's what the teachers are themselves. You have to teach, and you have to set the example if you expect the youngsters to execute the way that you would hope that they will be. Not in terms of being better than somebody else, but constantly making improvement toward becoming the best of which they're capable.
John Wooden has co-authored a brand new book called Be Quick, But Don't Hurry. Very interesting title, John. How'd you come upon this one?
Well, Andy, who's really responsible for this book and did it all, he remembered that in practice that's one of the things that they heard more than anything else is be quick, but don't hurry. I believe that's important. I didn't want activity without achievement, and I think when you hurry, you have activity, but you don't always get the achievement. But on the other hand, if you're not quick, you might not get to do things, whether it be playing basketball or driving the freeway or something else. You have to be quick, but you must never hurry. And Andy, years later, I began to realize that that and some of the other things that I had tried to teach in basketball, he was actually teaching in a very successful profession where producing such things as Touched by an Angel and Dr. Gwen Medicine Woman and Walker, Texas Ranger, and some others.
He was a player for you back in the 70s, was he not?
Played on three national championship teams.
And was he, you know, he wasn't the type of guy that would stand out like some of the big names that you had, but what was his contribution on those teams?
Well, he didn't get to play a lot, that is true, but I'll tell you, some of those players never get appreciated by what they do in the development of those they're playing ahead of them. And I know he was unhappy about it, but I expect that. I expect players. I want him to play, but he was needed. Everyone is needed. There's a role for every one of them. That Andy was a very bright person, as it showed when he has done well in business when he got out of school, and we made connections a while back, and it's just been very nice.
What are those carryover lessons in basketball, in coaching, in teaching, in sports that have been able to be carried over into one's personal life? What can be transposed, John?
Well, certainly consideration for others. You have to do that. To have teamwork, we have to have consideration for others. And then the value of hard work and enjoying what you're doing. I think that that's important, that to force yourself to work as hard as you should and to reach your own particular level of competency, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And I think these come out in sports, those things and plus the consideration for others. But there are other things to do, too, but I think those stand out.
You had a lot of great star players. You didn't like to have them be known as individual stars, but I'm wondering, there's been great debate in sport as to whether you treat stars on any player at any level differently than you do the regular player. What's your perspective on that, John?
Well, I never said, never promised players I'd treat them all alike. You're going to try to give each individual the treatment they earn and deserve. But you're imperfect, and you're going to be wrong at times, certainly. But if you're wrong too much, you know you won't be around very long. But I never wanted them to think they'd treat them all alike. I never wanted them to believe that I'd like them all the same. They wouldn't like each other all the same, and they wouldn't like me all the same. And I did hope that they would have respect for me, and I hope that, that they would grow to understand as time went by that I really loved them all, and I did. Regardless of whether those played a lot or those that didn't play so much. Some of them that I have the greatest affection for never played as much as some of the others.
How difficult is it to take a variety of talents and a variety of personalities and egos and blend them into one sophisticated operating unit like a basketball team?
I think that's one of the most difficult things that a teacher of any sport has to do, and that is to get them to work together for the welfare of the group as a whole. I have felt in watching Phil Jackson with the Lakers and formerly with the Bulls, his ability to get the other players to play their roles in order to help them have the best team, understanding that, for example, Shaquille and Kobe, they can't do without them, and they could be replaced much easier than Kobe or Shaquille could. But get them to accept that, and the same thing was true when he was with the Bulls, to get the other players to accept their roles and understand that Jordan and Pippen are probably going to get most of the publicity and most of the praise, but they wouldn't be on championship teams if they didn't have these others doing their job and accepting their job.
John, now over the years, at least in recent years, I think the only coach that really reminds me so much of you and your philosophy and the way you motivate and the success to some degree that you had is Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. When you look at him, do you see any similarities in the way he approaches the game, the way he coaches, and the success that he has that's anywhere near what and the way you approach the game?
Well, yes, I do, but I've also seen some others that haven't won national championships. One of the greatest pleasures I've had since my retirement happened just last year, just before the Final Four. I was speaking for the McDonald's High School All-American game in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, and Mike wanted me to come over and visit with him and talk with his players and then watch him conduct a practice, which I did, and that was just 2 days before they were leaving for the next day they left for Minneapolis for the Final Four, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the way he conducted practice. I actually felt that one of my strengths was my organization, the conducting of practice. I never considered myself much as a strategist or a great bench coach, but I did feel that my strength was in practice organization.
You know, when I take a look at the landscape in college basketball today, there are so many other dynamics that you didn't have to deal with, notably kids leaving early, the money being dangled in front of them. Has that changed the manner in which coaches have to approach kids and motivate them today? Is it different than the way you were? I mean, you were somewhat of a benevolent dictator in a sense, John.
I really don't think it's changed at all. I think you're still going to go after the same players and try to get them. No, you may not keep them as long, but I think too much concern is being made on the college program, their program being hurt because the better players leaving, many of them. I don't think we should be, paying too much attention to that. Let's pay attention to these youngsters giving up the education. There's very few of them that are going to be able to, like a Kobe and Garnett and some of those that make it big. For every one of those that make it big, many, many fail. And the average life of a pro player is in the NBA, I understand, is under 4 years. And I think we should be more concerned about what we can do to educate them to realize the value of their education.
Has college basketball, the cohesiveness, been changed a bit, John, because of the fact that coaches, when they recruit a blue-chip type of player, can't count on that player being there all 4 years like you could?
Well, the longer you have them together, the more team play you're going to have. And I felt all along that the players today, the athleticism is so remarkable. They've become so good individually that has hurt team play. I think coaches tend to let players go on their own a little more because they are so good and can get so much done individually. And I see better individuals, I think, the athleticism better than ever before, but I don't think I see as good team play as we used to have.
One of your former players also, and Hall of Famer, Bill Walton and I were chatting about what makes things successful today, and he says a coach's system to be successful, players have to buy into it, and he talked about you, and he put it this way.
If you're thinking about yourself, if you're thinking about the money, if you're thinking about the publicity and the statistics, and you're always blaming others for all the problems that inevitably come up in a group dynamic, it's never, ever going to work. And so you got guys like Riley, like Jerry Sloan, Phil Jackson, and Larry Brown succeeding for a long, long period of time, and you see their players over the years looking back and say, gee, was I ever so stupid. And when I talk to Coach Wooden, and I see him all the time, I apologize so profusely for being quite possibly the slowest learner that he's ever had.
Was he that slow, John?
Just the opposite. You know that. Bill had that way about him. He's a most interesting individual, very bright. You may not know when he was hurt. He was in the law school at Stanford for a while.
Right.
Then he came back and tried to play some more, but unfortunately his feet wouldn't permit them.
John Wooden touched many people, and he'll always be remembered and respected. Finally, in my broadcasting career, I've interviewed thousands of athletes. I'm often asked about my favorite athlete or interview. It's hard to just pick one, but on my short list of all-time favorite interviews and people is Adonal Foyle. Foyle is the personification of determination and personal success. He grew up on a small Caribbean island that was 3.5 miles by 1.25 miles with a population of 1,000. Raised by his grandmother and great aunt who gardened for a living by growing peanuts and other crops, his home had neither electricity nor running water. He didn't play organized basketball until he was 16. He was brought to the United States by a white couple who were professors at Colgate University. Under their guardianship, he got his degree from Colgate and was drafted in the first round by the Golden State Warriors. After a 13-year solid but undistinguished career, he recently announced his retirement. Given where he grew up, I asked Foyle if it blows him away that he played in the NBA for 13 years.
Absolutely blow me away. I mean, it's incredible. When you go back to the Caribbean and you kind of look at, and I look at where I came from, and kind of like pie in the sky. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. I told my mom that I wanted to leave the island with two complete strangers who later became my legal guardian. I mean, it was the craziest thing. You know, I have just met them, Jay and Joan Mandel, who became my legal guardian, they're professors from Colgate. I mean, when I look back and I'm like, after knowing these people for about a week, I said, I'm going to go to the United States and I'm going to go and play basketball and get an education. I mean, what a crazy notion for somebody who was living on an island of 500 people at the time. It's absolutely astonishing.
Tell me about the first time you picked up a basketball, because you were only 16 years old when you started playing.
It's like 15 and early 16, end of my 15th year. And I remember I just came from Canawan to Union, which is a big metropolis because they had about 3,000 people as opposed to the 500 in Canawan. And my first day, I was going to school. And my first day, there's a young man on the step, and he's like, man, you got to play basketball. And he just kept pestering me about playing basketball. You're tall. You got to play basketball. So I was like, after about a week of like, you know, man, get away from me. You know, it's bad enough. It's my first day of school. I'm the tallest person. I hated my height because everybody looked at me as, you know, this awkward person. And I went in the court, and I remember you explained the rules to me. And I said, okay, fine. You know, sounds good. And he told me to rebound, pass the ball to him, and he's dribbling between his legs and doing all this stuff. So I'm like, you know, man, why can't I do some of that? So, you know, I grab a ball, and I ran the length of the court, and I laid it up, and then I looked back, you know, expecting to get some high fives, and everybody was in the ground laughing, hysterical. Apparently, my zeal to run down the court, I had forgotten to dribble the ball. That was kind of my introduction to basketball. So when you think of that and you think about 13 years of basketball in the NBA, that's pretty incredible.
Did you take the basketball naturally and comfortably?
No, I did not. It was, I think what came natural was my running. Once I grew into my body, I loved to run. So I ran, I was very fast, and I had good timing. Those are the two things that I think initially that made me stand out. So after that, you know, it took a long time to kind of get to basketball, get the nuances of the game, the feel, the touch. I learned a lot from Mark Grable. He was a strength and conditioning coach over at Golden State. And he just had me do things like, you know, not seeing the ball and just turning around and whipping the ball at my head. And, you know, my instinct kicked in and I start, you know, getting a good feel for the ball. He worked with me a lot in that. And that, you know, definitely fortunate for Mark because he kept me in shape. He tried to figure out ways to get me because he figured like once I was in motion, I was good. Once you teach me something, I can keep it, you know. So he taught me a lot about the feel. And then Clifford Ray was when I really started to learn basketball when he came with Golden State. He really taught me a lot about the game.
One of the things that I've known about you in all the years that I've known you is the fact that I don't see you as the typical jock. I mean, you're articulate, you're intelligent, you went to Colgate, and I'm just wondering how hard, Donald, it was for you to acclimate yourself to the other nuances of the game, the in-your-face type of nuances.
I never did. I remember my first year in the league, I left Colgate a year early, and I remember my first year, you know, I was like, I'm going to finish my degree. And I came on the first road trip, and I had, like, about a bag of books. And I just remember the look that I got. You know, I had all of these books, and I sat down in the chair, and I had, like, stacks and stacks of books doing research. And I remember all the players came onto the plane, and they're just looking at me like, what is this kid doing? You know? But, I mean, that's kind of the way I've always been. I always thought that I was part of it and always on the outside of it because I never really fell for a lot of the stuff that, you know, frankly, that makes guys happy. Because I always felt that it was just a game and that it was just part of my life.
Your personal story is an interesting one as well. You've already alluded to the legal guardians. They were professors at Colgate University, a man and a woman. They were white, by the way. Tell me a little bit about how that relationship even came about.
Well, I think, you know, I had just started playing basketball, and I wasn't very good, but I was tall, and I can block a shot. And I remember the local team from my island, they had won the tournament that will send them to Dominica to play in this OECS tournament. And it was there that Jay and Joan, they were doing research. And at the time, they go down and they help out the referees, help manage the table, help out the referees with the rules and stuff. And he used to be a referee. So he loved going down to the Caribbean and teaching the game of basketball to the referees. And his wife managed the table. And his son was, you know, just looked on. And so we came into this tournament. We were a ragtag bunch. I mean, we dance onto the court. Whether we got killed by 40 or 50, we dance off the court. This was the first time many of us was leaving the island. So we were like in cloud nine. We were staying in this house with no AC, no nothing. And we thought this was the greatest thing ever. We were bathing in the river. And it was the most extraordinary thing. We had such a wonderful time. And you know, so they obviously fell in love with the team because we were losing, we're getting killed, and yet, you know, nobody could stop us. We were the happiest bunch in the tournament. So they came up to me and said, you know, have you ever thought about, you know, using your mediocre basketball skills to get an education? And the whole team decided that at that moment that they were going to take me to the States. So they're like, yes, he's going to go with you. And they're like, go where? We're just asking. We're not asking him to come with us. And they're like, no, you got to take him. So I remember, 2 weeks later, they said, you know, if you want to come, we have been talking to some people, and we think we can find you a place to go to stay in the United States, and we can go to school, and we can't promise anything. We don't know what's going to happen, but you know, we're going to try to help you get an education, and that's what I remember most. And not a week later, I was in the United States in Philadelphia, going to high school.
I remember running into the Sylvia touring team here in San Francisco, and a lot of those athletes had never been to the United States before, and I happened to be doing a television story on them, and I'll never forget going into a grocery store, and I bet it was 15 minutes that about five of those guys just stood there, their mouths open. They couldn't believe seeing that the shelves were stocked right, compared to what they saw in the Soviet Union. So let me turn it around a little bit. Let me ask you, you come to a country that you had heard of but could not even dream of or imagine, and you get to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of the largest cities, multicultural cities. Your first impressions?
Oh, it gets better. Before, I actually landed in New York because I was supposed to get to Philadelphia, but for some reason, I end up on a plane going to John F. Kennedy, and I had no idea. I've never really been in a plane before. I have never been in such a big city, and I am standing in the middle of the airport, and I'm thinking, I am gone. Somebody's going to take me and do something with me. I am forever gone. My mom is never going to hear from me again, and I'm standing completely lost and about to cry in the middle of JFK, and the prime minister of my country, who was on the flight with me, came with an entourage and swooped me up and took me to my plane and got me the plane to go to Philadelphia. I was not ready. You got to understand, and the island that I grew up on, Cano One, is about 3 miles long, and there were one car. It was a broken down, I can't even remember what it was. It was a yellow broken down something. I don't remember what it was. And I landed in Philadelphia, and it was an ocean of cars. I mean, there was a traffic jam about 7 miles long. I stood there like in dumbfounded. I could not believe it. I've never been in an elevator. I was so afraid that I would shake the elevator and it may fall down that I held my breath all the way up to the fifth floor and almost passed out. I've never been in an escalator. Everything was new. I've never had a pizza. I remember I ate a whole one the first time I was there. So everything that first year in Philadelphia was new for me. And I went around with my mouth open literally every day.
You go to Philadelphia, and as I already alluded to, a multicultural city and one that has sensitivities when it comes to race. You and I have talked about this before. Well, what was your first reaction, and did you run into any racism at all? And I would think that because you came from such a small island country, that you probably were oblivious to any of this, and it might have even protected you and helped you a little bit, O'Donnell, in dealing with some of the barbs that you may have run into.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the time, I was so lost. I spent that whole year in fog. I mean, everything was so new that I think I completely was oblivious to a lot of things that year. So I did not have any experience, negative anyway, that I was cognizant of at the time. Mainly, everything was so difficult for me, basketball-wise, learning. I mean, I was tall, but I wasn't strong. I was fast, but I wasn't flexible. So, I mean, everything was a learning process. But in terms of race, I didn't have a bad experience at all.
When you got to Colgate University, a very high academic school, what was that acclimation like?
That was difficult because I think leaving Philadelphia, it was so big, it's very, very big. And then you go to a place like Colgate where you're in a little town of about 1,300, and then Colgate is the central part of the town. And I was the one black person, I think, in the whole entire school. And, you know, the kids were looking at me like I was like a science project. So, it was fascinating. And I really become aware of, like, racism there. Not that it was towards me, but it was, like, the lack of knowledge about people like me. You know, and they were very great. You know, they used me a lot and talked to me about it, and they wanted to know what I thought about it because the perception that they had was what they saw on television, was there was nobody like me there in that town. So I think it was a kind of a learning process for all of us about race. And I felt like, you know, I was almost always like a show and tell. You know, this is O'Donnell. O'Donnell is black. O'Donnell is from the islands. And it was really fascinating. I mean, I felt great about it because it was genuine wanting to know my life story and wanting to experience what I experienced, and as an African American, as somebody from the Caribbean, and I think we grew together and learned quite a bit.
Let me ask you about expectations, because if you happen to be a black man, the sport is dominated by African Americans, black athletes, so there's an expectation they're going to be outstanding. If you happen to be big, there's what they call the big man's mentality of, well, and if you're going to be that big, you're probably going to be able to dominate as well. Did you have to deal with that along the way, and were you comfortable with everybody else's expectation of O'Donnell Foyle?
I think that in the Caribbean, it's like, I have never been a really aggressive person in terms of, like, you know, how I saw the game. The way the game was played, you know, is like you made a move, you know, but it wasn't, it was so physical. I think that the physical part of the game and understanding that, you know, for me, being a defensive player is about being like, not about laughing. I mean, I see very much of Dwight in myself. It's like when you're young, is that you're having fun and you're enjoying yourself. And then all of a sudden, it's like you're asked to corner a team and says, you need to carry this team and you need to do everything you possibly can. And I think that was a struggle because for me, I'm a very jovial, I'm happy-go-lucky kid from the islands, you know, everything. It was funny for me. I was having a good time, and coach would be there. Come on, you got to dominate. You got to rip this guy head off and spit down his throat and take this one and throw it. You know, so it was like, oh, my God, you want me to do that?
Somebody may not like me.
Exactly. So somebody might take offense to that. You know? So that was definitely something that I had to get used to. But I thought that once that I understood that this is how the game was played and it was different, then it got a lot easier.
Yeah. Let's also, what I'd be interested in is that when you knew that you were going to be able to maybe play at the next level, how did you approach that, and how did the people around you who were protective of you and wanted to help you with that approach it as well?
Well, it was scary because basketball, I had said that I wanted to do 4 years, and there was nothing that was going to stop me from doing 4 years. I wanted to graduate. I promised my mom that. And then, you know, after my sophomore year, going into my junior year, things, Coach and I, we didn't quite see eye to eye on a lot of things because we were challenging ourselves with the schedule, and I wasn't getting, I thought, the kind of quality teaching that I need. So the question became is that if I'm going to be playing in a conference that is not particularly powerful in terms of getting me prepared for the NBA, and I wasn't getting the individual attention, which is really what I wanted as a young player, then the question is, you know, what do I do? And then I think it so happened that after my junior year, we got a call saying, you know, you will go very high in the draft if you were to enter the draft. And my parents, being classic academians, they said, okay, let's have a conversation. And, you know, let's put everything on the table. And it was really interesting because, you know, my first impression was, no way, I'm not leaving. I'm going to spend my thing. And so we start talking about, okay, so what are the pros and cons? What do you want to do? Would you graduate even if you leave early? And the answer was, yes, of course, I'll graduate and I'm going to continue my education. So once that was answered, then it was, okay, now could you learn in terms of what would be your growth to spend another year from a basketball perspective, not an academic one? Because an academic one I knew I was going to do for the rest of my life. And the question became, you know, from a basketball perspective, the growth is probably going to be limited. Whereas if I go pro, I'll have an opportunity to learn quite a great deal. Is going to be difficult, but it will be a great opportunity to really push my game to the next level. Because after all, at this point, I was doing pretty well and very easily in the Patriot League. So I needed to get to the next challenge. And so, you know, we said, I think we just made a decision. and then I basically went pro.
Yeah, I don't know what you knew about the NBA or what you knew about draft day. Maybe you had seen it on television and everything. But what was the experience like when draft day comes about and you hear the name of Donald Foyle called out with the eighth pick?
Well, I just remember my poor mother. This was the first time she came to the United States, and she's sitting at the table and she is just petrified. And I am sitting there and I can't help her because I am a nervous wreck. And we're all looking at each other and we're like, you know, there's a very good likelihood that I'm not going to be drafted. You know, I think so. They keep telling me I might be, but, you know, the first number call, the second number, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm just going to be on national television. I'm never going to get picked up. So it was emotional. I was an emotional wreck. And, you know, when my name was called and I went across the stage and shook the commissioner's hand, I had no idea what to expect. I mean, absolutely no idea, because I paid attention to the NBA, but it was so difficult academically and basketball wise to balance those two things that I didn't have a lot of time, you know, to watch NBA basketball. So it was really, really shocking when I really got into the league and really see what was expected of me.
And speaking of shocking, obviously, once you got into the league, and we've talked about this before, what was it that did shock you first and foremost?
The absolute different disparity in strength and knowledge of the game. I think when the one thing is that when you look from the outside, you look at an NBA player and you think, you know, it's just another NBA player. And the respect that I had for NBA guys, but when you get to the NBA, you realize that they're PhDs in basketball, that they may do stupid things, they may do this, they may be great guys, but they're absolutely brilliant in the game. That they're not there by accident. They're actually are very gifted. They understood the game. They understand the game. They know things that coaches didn't know. I had Terry Cummins, Felton Spencer, Muggsy Bogues, Dwayne Farrell. You know, I had Joe Smith, Latrell Sprewell. I mean, I had all these people, and they've been in the game for a very long time. And I think it's the gap the knowledge gap was very, very surprising, and the strength gap, how strong and physically gifted that they were.
A Donald Foyle, a man who pursued his dream. I hope you've enjoyed World Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcasts on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 122, and the Internet. If you'd like a listing of Sports Byline's radio affiliates, be sure to check out our award-winning website at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.